You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Here on Nighttime, I've made it my mission to highlight Canada's lesser-known stories. In some cases, the episodes serve as a celebration of the weird and wonderful events that occur often unnoticed in the cities and provinces we live in. An example of this would be my past episode covering the odd stories I've collected from Tim Hortons restaurants around Nova Scotia. In other cases, the content is much more complicated. There are the stories in which I feel coverage could affect change, missing persons cases like Michaela Bali's, Troy Cook's, or Emma Philippoff's are all suitable examples of this. Then there are the true crime retrospectives, the episodes that temporarily shine a light on some of Canada's darkest moments. These would be topics like the life of Rohini Baisasar, and of course the mass murder that occurred in a McDonald's restaurant in Cape Breton. In this episode, tonight, our topic is an unsolved murder that blends together all the aforementioned elements. Like my prior episode covering the murder of Sadie Rogers, this story will be told by way of a conversation between Frank Magazine's crime writer Bev Keddie and I. Readers of Bev's column may be familiar with this case, as it was recently featured in a piece Bev wrote for Frank titled "The Sad Life and Lonely Death of Douglas Keating." As you'll soon hear, this story will be a bit different than other cases I've covered, and not just because of the format or the length of this episode. Whenever I covered murder cases, I've generally favored ones in which the victim had little to no reason to find themselves at risk of violence. In this case, however, the victim's personal circumstances have provided him a life with many more downs than ups. The victim, in fact, made news for crimes he was committing. He served time in prison, and he certainly made a lot of enemies along the way. But that said, no one deserves to be found beaten to death on a popular walking trail, or anywhere else for that matter. And certainly, no one deserves to have their murder go unsolved. What will come next is a discussion covering the life of Douglas Keating, the disorganized string of bank robberies he carried out around Halifax, Nova Scotia, and of course, the violent murder that ended his life. Now, Bev, when I read your article on Douglas Keating, I was sucked in right from the beginning. Your opening couple lines are so powerful. Can you read that? Just for the listeners, I think this will draw them in.
And my editor liked it a lot, too. He said it was my best opening sentence, opening paragraph. So here it goes. It is axiomatic that bad things can happen to good people, but a corollary is equally true. Otherwise, good people can do bad things and have their lives spin out of control as a result. For an example, we need look no further than the sad life and lonely death of Douglas Clarence Keating.
A good way to open it, because a sad life and lonely death,
yeah,
it's almost like a sad life and kind of a pathetic end. Like this whole story is, I was reading it just getting depressed because it's just so much like failure and kind of tragedy, yeah, compounding. I would almost say Douglas Keating's story comes across almost as like, in a way, it was like somebody was trying to write a heist movie, but it's just the character, just like nothing kind of worked out for him. Instead, it's just this kind of hopeless tragedy. So maybe we'll start at the beginning. Tell me a bit about Douglas Keating's life before the crime we'll eventually get to.
Well, he was born on December 12th, 1961. His parents were Clarence and Sheila. His parents split, and his mom, who was named Sheila, married a guy named Joseph Dixon. So he became a stepfather to Doug, and Doug had a whole bunch of siblings, something like 8 younger siblings. And Doug liked to play pool, and he was good at it. He liked to won several tournaments as well. He coached baseball and hockey, but he always worked at sort of blue-collar, lower white-collar type jobs his whole life. Never had a whole lot of education, and grew up dirt poor.
Where was it that he grew up?
In the Chocolate Lake area.
Of Halifax.
Of Halifax, yes. So he had a lot of friends from Spryfield. And this was, like today, the Chocolate Lake area is fairly urban.
Oddly, it's about a block that way.
Yeah, we're pretty close to it.
We're right there.
It's a nice part of town. But back in the day, it was a little seedier, and this is where the poorer folks ended up living.
Yeah. Now, before, you know, the crime that will eventually, or the crimes will eventually get to, was he in, like, as a younger man and growing up, was he involved in trouble, or are you aware of him being a trouble before? I understand he left Nova Scotia and headed west for a time. Before that, do you know of him ever having any kind of bumps in the road?
Well, I found a friend of his from back in the day who agreed to speak to me on the condition of anonymity, so I changed her name for the article. But yes, he had some issues growing up. There was a lot of drinking, and there were some drugs. He had blackouts. And one time during one of these blackouts, he broke into a friend's house and stole his friend's mother's jewelry, woke up the next morning and did not know where that jewelry had come from. Okay. So eventually it was found out who had their jewelry stolen. He returned it, and I don't know how much sucking up he had to do to his friend and to the mother to make things right again, but It was just symbolic of what trajectory his life was taking.
Yeah. Now, so as you mentioned, he grew up in Halifax, had this kind of trouble. So that story gives you kind of a sense of what kind of life he was living. But I understand his trouble mainly started after he went out west, as a lot of Nova Scotians, young people do. They'll go out west to work or whatnot. When he was out west, you know what had changed for him out there?
Well, he went to be with his birth father in a place called High Level, Alberta. And when he was out there, I think that without his mother's influence, or maybe the influence of the friends he had left behind, my understanding is he did a lot more drinking and gambling and drugs. So he eventually got away from that and moved to British Columbia, where he ended up living with an older woman who I hope had a calming influence on him. But my friend who knew him, for whatever reason, he sent her a picture of him lying on a couch with his mullet and playing with a family cat. So I'm not sure if he was sweet on her or what it was, but he seemed to have found some kind of measure of happiness in British Columbia. But there was some kind of family emergency back in Nova Scotia, which caused him to return here. And that's when things really went off the rails for him.
And you know, when he came back from out west to Nova Scotia with this family trouble, do you know how old he would have been?
Well, he was born in 1961, and he came back in October of 1994. So let me do the math. He would have been
30,
about 23 thereabouts.
Okay,
like that. Yeah,
we're not very good.
Yeah.
So comes back as a young man.
Wait a minute now.
Let's do that.
Let's do the math again. 1961. 1971, 1981, 1991. So he was 33. He was 33. Off by 10 years. I apologize for that.
That's fine. That's fine. Just for the record, I was right. I said 33.
Yeah, you were absolutely right, and I was absolutely wrong.
So he came back as a 33-year-old.
Yeah.
So I guess that doesn't change our point. He was a young man, had a problem with alcohol, seemed to have a problem with drugs and gambling that he kind of developed out west. He came back to Nova Scotia, and this is when kind of the first round of real trouble happens. And this, when I originally read your story about the murder of Douglas Keating, this part of it really shocked me. When he came back from out west, living again in Halifax, now as a 33-year-old, just tell me a bit about how he made news and what he got into.
Well, starting in December of 1994, so 6 weeks or 8 weeks or so when having returned out west, as we started hitting banks, he started robbing banks. He robbed 6 banks between December 8th, 1994 and April 20th, 1995. And he made off with a total of $27,221. He had a method of operation where he would just walk up to the teller, hand her a note, say, "This is a stick-up." He was holding a newspaper and what appeared to be something wrapped in newspaper that could have been perceived as a gun. Turned out to be just a tube or something, but of course they had no way of knowing that, so they would always comply with his request and give him money, and he would just saunter out of the bank as if it were nothing.
As if he wasn't being filmed without a mask on walking into a bank.
Exactly. He would just saunter out of the bank as if it were nothing. There was one time when he actually left his car running out in front of the bank with the four-way flashers on. He didn't.
So he just pulled up, left the car running, walked in without a disguise.
Yeah, and robbed it and drove home. And he lived in Vimy Avenue, and all of those banks I mentioned, those six banks, were within walking distance of his apartment.
So he's just robbing the banks in the neighborhood without a disguise. And so as you can imagine to the listener out there, it wasn't long before justice was served.
Yes, in April of 1995, there was a news report on television where the police ran a still image of him. I believe I sent you a picture of that still image. And he was recognized, the police caught him, and he cooperated with them. He was polite and everything else. Maybe he was relieved to be finally caught.
Yeah, well, I can only imagine his life. It just seems of an act of desperation, a disorganized robbing spree of the banks in your neighborhood while you're presumably having problems with gambling debt and drugs. And it just seems like he was just spiraling out of control anyway. So maybe he was relieved, because what I had read was even in his court appearances, he was polite, cooperative, and seemed to not, you know, he told the whole story when they arrested him.
Yeah, as he explained, he admitted to his problem. He goes, "I did the robberies for the need, not the greed. I have debts from gambling and bills to pay." That's the way he explained it to the court.
Just handled it like a working man kind of take on it.
It looks that way, and he was he had these debts, and this is his desperate way of trying to pay them.
What kind of time did he served behind bars?
He did about 5 years in jail. So this was in March or April of 1995, and he went to jail. He was out of prison about 5 years later and went back to living in Vimy Avenue, which is in the Fairview area, part of Halifax. And a few months later, he was murdered. He was last seen alive on September 1st, 2000. Very close to his apartment.
So, and this was, how long after being released from prison?
Well, I'm saying he was in jail for 5 years. So okay. Sometime 5 years and a few months later, he got out of jail. So it wasn't long after he got out of jail that he was murdered.
Okay. And what is the details of his murder? I understand he was found on a walking trail that's actually not far from where I live. There's a network of walking trails that go throughout Halifax. The part where his body was found was in a portion kind of at the top of Fairview, not too far from where he was living at the time.
Yeah, it's close to a water tower behind 299 Main Avenue. So I'm not sure whether that's relative to you, and we don't need to reveal that here for the podcast.
People who listen to my podcast would know that area as being very near to the site of the Bears Lake Mystery Walls, because this is very close to Bears Lake, where at the time when he was found there would have been kind of been a wooded area. Okay. But now the roads leading up to Bears Lake are all cleared and whatnot. So it's a different scene now, but then it would have been on the very edge of the city.
Yep. And he had been beaten to death.
Okay.
So he was just blunt force trauma, the way the article in the newspaper described it, but he had been beaten to death.
In everything I had read, I didn't find any kind of story as to where he was, who may have done it. It seems like he was just going about his life and then was found beaten to death at the edge of town.
He owed money to people to whom you do not want to owe money. I'm thinking there was some organized crime there. I don't want to give voice to who it might have been. I don't know specifically who it might have been, but there are people in this province to whom you do not want to owe money. You do not want to run afoul of them. And he obviously did.
Yeah. And where he was, I did read that where he was found wasn't where the beating took place. They have, They didn't say what, but there is evidence that he was dropped there. Yeah. He was dropped off on the edge of town. So
yeah, they beat him up and killed him and dumped his body there at 299 Main Avenue. Yes,
which would just the idea of moving a body just seems already it's a bit more organized than like he wasn't punched in the face outside of a bar and hit his head. This is somebody came and got him.
They made an example of Doug Keating. Mm-hmm. Whoever it was, they said, look what happened to Doug Keating. You want to pay your gambling debts to me.
Yeah. Now, during your time researching this case, writing your article in Frank, and then since then, have you been in touch with anyone close to Doug Keating or received response from any of your readers?
This friend of his, who I was in touch with her, and she liked the article very much, but I have not been in touch with any of his siblings. One of his sisters died. She had special needs, and she died a number of years ago. The other siblings, I have not been in touch with any of them, no. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if the mother's still alive, but for many years after his death, she would go to the cemetery there in Fairview and make sure that the grave was kept clean and everything. She obviously loved her son. Mm-hmm. And Doug grew up in very poor circumstances, and not the least of which was the fact that there was a divorce in the family, but lots of people grew up in families of mm-hmm. where there was a divorce and they persevere, but that plus all the poverty and the negative influences in his life really led to him going down a path that from which you can't get the exit mm-hmm. ramp.
Yeah, and it's although he had crime in his background and problems with drugs and gambling and drinking, that doesn't make it any more of a tragedy to have someone's life cut short. He doesn't deserve if whatever social or legal problems he had, there's other ways to deal with it. So this is a sad story, and he's a sad victim because he had a lot going against him. And you talked about there about the divorce and whatnot. I come from a family where my parents split up early, and I think it's for people who haven't experienced that. There's the time in your life when you're young and growing, and you know your family is your support system. Yeah. So if you already have things working against you like poverty, and then you on top of that pull the rug out from somebody by breaking up the family, you mentioned he lived with his mom who remarried. Yeah. So I can kind of put myself in his shoes as maybe feeling a little lonely and left out and defeated to start, and then on top of that you get a taste for gambling, drugs, and alcohol. Obviously, his life was spiraling out of control, which led to the disorganized bank robberies. Yes. He probably came out of prison 5 years later with no money, nobody to turn to, nothing to live for. And seeing how his life ended, I can see him kind of falling back to his same bad habits.
I've written about a number of people like Doug Keating over the last couple of years. And generally speaking, there are very few inherently evil people in this world, and I've always taken the side of the people I'm writing about. I'm trying to humanize all of them, and the one about Doug Keating is the one that really resonated with me the most, because he never could get a break in life. And sometimes you have to make your own breaks, but you have to be given some tools to work with at the same time, and he was never given those tools to work with. So I feel horrible for what happened to Doug, and I feel terrible that his murder has never been solved, and I feel even worse again that it's been forgotten about. So I hope my article and I hope this podcast can help keep the story of Doug Keating alive, and maybe we'll get some tips for solving his murder.
I want to dedicate this episode to the memory of Douglas Keating and express my condolences to his family and friends. As I've said before and during the episode, no one is perfect, including Doug. He certainly made some bad choices during his life, likely for reasons only he understands fully, but I do know that no one's life should end in the undignified way his had. And on that note, I'd like to use this time to make a plea to anyone listening that may have information regarding the person or persons responsible for the murder of Douglas Keating. the government in Nova Scotia is offering rewards of up to $150,000 for information leading to the arrest and conviction for the people or person responsible for Doug's murder. If your bank account looks like mine, or even if it doesn't, you should still do the right thing and call the Rewards for Major Unsolved Crimes program at 1-888-710-9090 and tell them what you know. And with that, we'll conclude this episode of Nighttime. I want to thank Bev Keddie for again joining me to discuss the lesser reported crimes committed in and around Nova Scotia. I find it incredible how dedicated Bev is to the victims of these crimes, regardless of their personal circumstances. I'd also like to thank Frank Magazine editor Andrew Douglas for letting Bev out of his cage long enough to take part in this episode. For anyone out there that isn't easily disgusted by the malfeasances of our elected officials or turned off by the greed of our neighbors, you may be interested in subscribing to Frank. You can find them at frankmag.ca. I want to thank the Ottawa-based dark wave duo Paragon Cause for providing tonight's music. Their debut album, Escape, is available now, and it's awesome. If you're interested in hearing more content, please check out the Nighttime Patreon group, where for $1 a month you can support the show and access supporter-exclusive bonus content like videos, bonus audio, and prior episodes no longer available on the main feed. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. I'd like to thank the current patrons of the show and welcome the newest members of the group, Julie O'Brien and Jason Izenga. I sincerely appreciate you supporting Nighttime and becoming a patron last month. For anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can lend me a hand by telling your friends about me and leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whichever equivalent you use. If any of you listening want to stay up to date with my activities, both on and off the show, follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I use the handle @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or feedback, I'd love to hear from you. NighttimePodcast@gmail.com. So until next time, keep looking around and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.